Hello and welcome back to Lifetime Cinema Club. I'm your host, Ryan, and I'm here for season two. Loyal listeners would have last heard us conclude season one, which is our seasons basically are the breakdown of a year. And it's a year of film. If you haven't caught up with our podcast yet, we pick the 10 best films. Well, I do. I pick what I consider to be the 10 best films from each year that I've been alive. So we started in 1980, and that was season one. And we've completed season one. If you haven't listened, go back. Go back and have a listen. We concluded season one, 1980. The number one, the numero uno film of 1980 was The Shining, directed by Stanley Kubrick. A pretty obvious choice, I guess, but no doubt the right one. And along with me on this journey of year-by-year breakdown, I basically bully one of my good mates and my co-hosts into watching these movies that I've picked, and I hope like hell he likes them too. And so far, so good, I believe. But my co-host tonight, as always, is Holsh. How you doing, buddy?
It's good to hear your voice again. It's been a while, Chip. You're right. You nailed those first 10 in 1980, and I've been on an absolute movie binge over the last month and a half while we had our little hiatus over the break. So I'm in full movie mode.
Well, first of all, Happy New Year, Merry Christmas, all of those shenanigans.
Same to you, mate. Same.
Good to hear that you've been on a bit of a binge. I know that you've been trying to get through films we've got listed that are coming up, and obviously I've shared with you what my selections are. And then you obviously go on a bit of a yearly discovery yourself.
Yeah.
Have there been any standouts? For no spoilers, nothing that we're going to talk about in the next few episodes or next few years, I guess. But are there any pre-1980 classics that you've watched recently that really kind of blew your skirt up, as they say?
Yeah, mate. I've watched a few and it varies deeply between absolute tripe and some gold. And a couple of movies I watched for the first time was Carrie, Brian De Palma, Stephen King take on the movie. And I thought it was incredible, especially the last 30 or 40 minutes of it. I thought the first hour was here or there, but then it finishes just immaculate. So that was great. And I mean, Vanilla Sky, which I mentioned to you a few days ago, I rewatched it. I'm deeply in love with that movie. It just takes me deep into it and emotionally into it. And I don't know why, because I didn't think Tom Cruise would ever do that for me, but it's a movie that's close to my heart. But on the other hand as well, there's a little bit of crap in there as well. And one of them was, I watched the Indiana Jones series again. And
oh no.
And the thing is, I was expecting the last two to be, you know, I had low expectations for those two, and they sort of hit the mark. They were low in expectation. But the one that surprised me was Last Crusade. How much Sean Connery irked me, and I really just did not enjoy The Last Crusade. But
yeah, you sent me quite a few texts ranting about how much he was pissing you off in that movie. I got great amusement out of that.
Yeah, the first two, absolute classics, and enjoyed them thoroughly. But yeah, I was really surprised The Last Crusade just didn't do it for me. But no, mate, I could get real on and on. But yeah, a little bit of a taste of what I've been watching in the man cave.
Vanilla Sky is a great shout. That's such a an interesting film. I stumbled across the film that it is a remake of years ago on SBS. For those who are living elsewhere from Australia, SBS is like a national broadcast channel in Australia that shows a lot of international film. Mm. And the film called Open Your Eyes. Have you seen the original at all?
No, I haven't. Hasn't it got one of the same actors or in that?
Yeah, film? So Penelope Cruz, who I absolutely adore, so she is in that. And I believe her romance with Tom Cruise basically kicked off on the set of Vanilla Sky. But yeah, anyway, I'm rambling on. But Vanilla Sky is fucking money. Mm. There are some shots in that film that I absolutely adore. The way they managed to clear out Times Square is just incredible. That will always, that kind of shot will always stick with me. I was lucky enough to see that in the cinema when it came out. It was, yeah, quite the experience, that one.
Mm.
Well, that's good. I'm glad that I've kind of kicked off some type of obsession that you've got. Not only are you watching a lot of film, but your physical media purchases are just going through the roof. So I apologize to your family too. You're probably all singing for your supper or eating like baked beans on toast or something, because nary a sale of physical media comes online that you are not buying up on.
It's interesting. Before we jump on to the number 10 for 1981, I looked at how many movies you've watched in your lifetime and logged on Letterboxd. So, you know, there's probably more than this. And you have watched 5,449 flicks. Now, if we average that over the last 100 years, that's 55 movies a year that you've watched over 100 years. Now, I thought for 1980, when I stuck to my guns and watched 39 movies from that year, I was like, oh, that's pretty comprehensive. But this is 55 movies a year over a century. So I've got some catching up to do. And yeah, you've inspired me.
Oh, man. Just, and I'm going to retrace these steps a little bit when I talk about number 10. But man, when I was a kid, I watched so many movies on school holidays. I got to watch 3 or 4, sometimes 5 movies a day. And then my first job coming out of high school, while I was at university, my little side gig was working at a video store like Blockbuster. So I was surrounded by movies for years and did nothing but smoke weed and watch a lot of movies on the couch. So, which is kind of typical university student behavior, I would imagine. And I was a university dropout. But look at me now. Just look at me now.
You finally made it.
Yeah. It's amazing. But yeah, let's not beat around the bush anymore. We're into our second season. So this is the top 10 films, what I consider to be the top 10 films. And I've tasked you, Holsch, to watch them along with me. This is for 1981. Now, this film, even though it's coming in at number 10, could possibly be the film that means the most to me. And it's kind of weird that it's placed so lowly in this year. And that's purely just out of me not wanting to overrate it due to being sentimental about it. But also, look, now that I've grown up, I still love the movie. I still get a lot from it. But I realize it isn't the greatest thing that came out this year. But it is probably one of the most important movies for me. And it is an absolute stone-cold action classic from the god John Carpenter. And number 10 is Escape from New York.
Welcome to Lifetime Cinema Club.
All right, so Escape from New York. This is a, like I said, a stone-cold classic. And as per usual, I will read through the really brief plot synopsis that Letterboxd provides just for a bit of a rundown. I'm assuming there's quite a few. If anyone's listening to this and they're over the age of, I'd say, 30, there's a 90% chance they've seen this movie, but I'll still go through with the synopsis. The first part makes me laugh. 1997. So far in the future. That is great. So 1997, New York City is a walled maximum security prison. Breaking out is impossible. Breaking in is insane. In a world ravaged by crime, the entire island of Manhattan has been converted into a walled prison where brutal prisoners roam. After the US president crash lands inside, war hero Snake Plissken has 24 hours to bring him back. So I guess a pretty simplistic kind of premise, made pretty much on the cheap. I had a look, Holsch, at what the budget was on this. I think it was around $6 or $7 million. And I think the box office return on this when it finally left theaters was around $50 or $60 million. So it was quite the money spinner. But it has always forever been kind of relegated to cult classic status. When you look at how it got to that kind of status, it's pretty obvious, right? Like, I would have to say this is one of my favorite casts for any film I've ever seen. It is just filled to the brim with incredible faces, incredible characters. This is just wall-to-wall people working in their prime or slightly past their prime for a couple of these guys, but this is just phenomenal. So I'll read out who is on the cast list. So you got Kurt Russell, Lee Van Cleef, just the spaghetti Western legend, Ernest Borgnine, which is just incredible. He plays Cabby. Donald Pleasance, Isaac Hayes, one of the great soul and funk singers of all time, Harry Dean Stanton, Adrienne Barbeau, Tom Atkins. We got Frank Doubleday. Now, this dude here also appeared in a previous film with John Carpenter, Assault on Precinct 13, and he is the absolute, if you've seen that movie, he is the absolute psychopath that shoots a kid right in the chest as they're getting an ice cream. So this is genre movie heaven, this cast. The other thing that stands out as soon as this film kicks into gear is the score, which obviously was written and produced, made by our man John Carpenter as well. Holsch, this was, I'm assuming, is this the first time you've seen it for this project?
It was. I can't believe it. I've now watched it four times. When you brought it up, that was the first time. In fact, I haven't really seen any John Carpenter stuff. I was such a scaredy cat when I was a kid, and obviously he had like The Fog and The Thing and all these sorts. And mate, I was scared of Ghostbusters, so I just sort of I kept John Carpenter at an arm's length, but I'm really loving everything that I've watched so far. I haven't gone past 1981, but Halloween and The Fog and obviously Escape to New York, just all bona fide classics.
That's excellent, man. I love that you're seeing this with fresh eyes. So I don't want to bore people, but my personal interaction or personal history with this film is quite meaningful for me. And look, I know this movie now, like this movie is muscle memory. I've seen this film, I'm going to say probably 20 times. This is a film that I would quite often just put on as I was going to sleep, probably to the detriment of my sleeping patterns. I've always had a TV and a VHS or a DVD player in my room. And quite often I'll always put on a movie as I'm going to sleep. And for many number of years, this was a film that I'd put on as I was going to sleep. But the reason I love this movie so much is I am an only child, and my parents both worked two jobs and both worked full time. So during school holidays, I would be in the care of, I'd be at home by myself. I had to learn how to cook some meals and not burn the house down, but I'd be just plopped in front of the TV from the age of 10 and just be watching movies. I know that sounds a bit weird and almost sounds like it's borderline child neglect, but I loved it and it's turned me into what I am today. I don't have any formal film study training or anything like that. I'm just purely a cinephile thanks to watching so many movies. And this is probably the first movie that I ever truly fell in love with. And there were other movies that I saw before this that, you know, I really enjoyed, but this is the first film that I really obsessed over. And I believe I would have been 10 when I first saw this. So that would have been, that puts it at about 1989, 1990. So the film would have been about 9 or 10 years old. What we used to do, I used to go to the Blockbuster or the video store on a weekend. And in Australia, it's probably the same elsewhere, but in Australia, there would be these deals where you could hire 7 weekly films or 7 films that have been older films, they're not new releases, 7 weekly rental films for $7. I would very much take the piss. So I would walk around the video store and I'd take my mother and I'd be like, Mum, I want this. Mum, I want this. And look, at times she was like, you can't get that. You can't have this, because there'd be like obviously things that were R-rated or really scary or overly sexual or something that are just inappropriate for a 10-year-old to watch. But this one got through good old gatekeeping Mum. This one went through. Thank God it did, because when I watched this, I had never seen anything cooler. And still to this day, it's a fucking cool movie. Everything about this movie is cool. The set design, despite how cheap it looks and everything, it's just dark and menacing. And the matte paintings that have been used, obviously we've touched on already, the soundtrack, the characters, everything about this movie is cool. And because of my age and the generation I grew up in, obviously, Star Wars, there was the really two big franchises that were around when I was around this age were obviously Star Wars, and you just touched on it before, Holsch, was Indiana Jones. So kids were like really into being Luke Skywalker or Han Solo or Indiana Jones. And I'm like, yeah, what about Snake Plissken? To all my mates at school. And everyone's like, who the fuck is that? Snake Plissken. Because I just thought everyone had seen it. But I realized that I'd watched a movie that was probably slightly too mature for my age. I was just obsessed with this film. That's my story. And that's why it means a lot to me. I am really, really happy that you had a good, positive reaction to it, Holsh, because I have rewatched it again recently. Like I said, this film is muscle memory for me. I haven't had a really recent rewatch. I haven't watched it in the last week or two. I rewatched it about 2 or 3 months ago and loved it. But I started to think, oh, I don't know. I don't know if this is going to appeal to Holsh. I don't know if this is going to, you know, I knew you'd dig the music. I knew you'd dig that.
Mm.
You know, some of the performances, some of the dialogue's pretty pretty wooden. There's some pretty weird editing choices through the film, but I'm just stoked that you can see through that and just see its charms. Because, you know, despite all of its flaws, it's a really charming movie as well. It's action-packed. It's got a lot of humor in it. But, yeah, that's my history with Escape from New York.
Yeah, look, mate, every watch that I've had of it, it becomes more and more fun. Now that I've got a little bit of muscle memory with it as well, like I have these moments coming up in the film that I really look forward to because it either gives me a smile because it's absurd or it gives me a smile because it's just that grimy. It's got both ends of the spectrum there. But I remember having a conversation with you before I'd even watched it the first time and how you essentially said this was your Empire Strikes Back of your childhood compared to,
yeah.
You know, most people were huge on the Star Wars bandwagon and, you know, everyone at the time, you know, wanted to be Luke Skywalker or Superman, these characters that just had these traditional virtues, not this anti-hero Snake Plissken that's wearing these combat striped tight pants that look like, you know, you rip off his shirt and he's going to be a WWF tag team operator with the eye patch and all the rest of it. It's
and the mullet and the beautiful mullet.
Film is really built around his character, this guy that's basically saying, look, I have absolutely no aspirations. I have no care for anyone. It's probably even questionable if he really cares that much about himself, but he's a guy that just gets shit done. Okay, you know, I could not give a rat's about basically anything on this planet, especially the system, the man, but he still has this apparent will to survive. And just watching his interactions with all different sorts of characters having this nonchalant, like just doesn't, nothing phases him apart from the odd time where someone gives him the shits. I just thought it was such a breath of fresh air for the movies that we've been watching up to date. To have a hero like this, it's the first one. He's really stuck out from everything else that we've watched to this point in time.
Yeah.
Let's just go back to the premise. How cool is it? The president is getting flown in and basically smashes into New York, which is a maximum security prison, and we're sending one bloke in to save him in 24 hours. Like that by itself, if someone read that, man, who wouldn't want to pick up this movie and watch it?
Yeah, it's incredible. It's such a exciting premise. And look, I also want to go back and I can be subconsciously contrarian and I don't mean to be all the time. And before watching Escape from New York for the first time when I was 10 years old, I was a massive Star Wars kid, you know, like everyone else and into Superman and all that kind of stuff too. It was all, but then when I saw this, I'm like, holy shit. And I think it was the attraction, and you touched on it, is that anti-hero thing. It's like, he truly doesn't give a fuck. It's the president of the United States. Every other hero I'd seen had jumped at the chance to save the president or save this. He's like, he wouldn't have done it unless they injected that shit into his veins, right? He basically says to him, he can fucking get himself out of there, right? So this was my first time ever encountering a character like that in a film. And, man, it was just... it just blew my 10-year-old mind. I was obsessed with this movie. Yeah, I'm really glad that you enjoyed it, Holsh. And look, there are so many notable scenes throughout it. Well, one thing that I'm surprised, well, you almost just mentioned it before, and I'm sure you picked up on it, was that opening scene. I worry there's, I don't want to say the wrong thing and offend people, but there's probably some ideas being kicked around certain terrorist cells in the late 90s. They saw this film of this glider, of this aircraft flying in towards the World Trade Center and then obviously landing on top of it. That dawned on me on a rewatch not long after September 11. I was like, holy shit. I wonder if the idea came from that. But anyway, I don't want to get all dark on the pod about that. But Holsch, what were some of the like standout scenes for you? I've got a couple that I'd like to go over for you, mate. Considering this is fairly new for you, what were some of the scenes that stood out for you?
The first one I'll mention is on the back of my probably favourite performance in the film, and that is of Frank Doubleday acting as Romero, the gentleman that's batshit crazy. Sort of, he feels like he's sort of half Steve Buscemi, half...
good call.
Half like Christopher Walken and Steve Buscemi sort of merged together sort of thing. Probably one of my favourite moments, which is also a scene in itself, is when Hauk, who's Lee Van Cleef, when they come in to basically in their first attempt to pull the president out straight after the crash, and Ramira is the gentleman that's sort of standing at the end of the street and comes forward. He's got this crazy laugh. Right from the get-go, he just grabs you with his laugh, and the moment when he starts saying, "You touch me, he dies."
You touch me, he dies. If you're not in the air in 30 seconds, he dies. If you come back in, he dies.
I'm ready to talk.
19. 18.
What do you want?
17. 16.
Let's go.
And the way that he delivers this and then shows the finger of the president with the ring on it, Lee Van Cleef is basically trying to shut him down, and this bloke's just having none of it. You've just come into my world now, baby. If you're going to do that, don't expect to leave because we've got your measure. I think that sets up the dystopian world so beautifully, the way that him as Romero delivers those lines to Hauk. He basically takes control. What's your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, absolutely. That just sets up the chaos and what they've flown into. That scene really freaked me out when I was a kid. That guy was like, I was like, oh, this dude is just terrifying and he's just threatening to kill everybody. And, you know, that was such a great scene. And you said it beautifully, Holsch. It kind of sets the stage for what type of what area they've gone into, right? So it's just become this lawless, chaotic den of you think of the worst people on earth and they're in there. One of my favourite scenes is a slight reprieve from that, and only momentarily, is when Snake's actually gone into the exclusion zone in there in Manhattan, has gone into the theatre.
Oh, yes.
Where there's the play, and there's Ernest Borgnine playing Cabby, who... Man, what a breath of fresh air in this movie. He's just always so jovial and like happy. And they're watching this weird makeshift play. The audience members, again, everyone that's in there is a hardened criminal. All these people are just glaring at the stage. Cabby's sitting there like bopping along with this massive, massive smile on his face, big bright eyes. Snake walks past him to go backstage and downstairs, and he kind of looks up and you can see him recognize it. And there begins that ongoing joke of when anyone comes across Snake and they recognize him because he's this massive cult hero. They go, "Snake Plissken, I heard you were dead." I just love that as well. So that's another scene that I love. And it quickly gets darker. Like there's that little bit of slight humor watching Cabby's reaction to the play. But then as Snake goes into the depths of the basement or of the downstairs area of the theater, things get more and more depraved. We see some really weird shit. And then basically he's chasing the monitor that he thinks he's going to find the president down there. And unfortunately, he does not. I love that you enjoyed that scene. And you look, you know, the naming of the characters, Romero and Cronenberg, in this is obviously not a coincidence. Carpenter's obviously name-checked a few of his buddies in the film industry and put them in as characters in the film.
Did you notice every single person in the film that says,
"But I heard you were dead"? I thought you were dead.
I thought you were dead.
Every single person that says that dies in the film.
I didn't realize that.
Little tidbit. Yeah, every single one. I
never realized that.
If you go back through it, as soon as you see it, that's basically their death call.
So, there you go. I've seen it 25 times, and that's never really clicked with me. As soon as you said that, I'm like, well, of course, that's right. Yeah. I just mentally went through every character's kind of arc and ultimate demise. I'm like, yep, you know what? You are absolutely correct. I didn't realize.
What's that?
Is I didn't realize that Jamie Lee Curtis was the narrator.
I know. It's so obvious, too, when you hear it now.
Oh, easily. I only just discovered that, not just for this, but only recently, like a couple of years ago. So I watched this for the first time 35 years ago, and I only just realized it probably a year ago that she was the – and that was thanks to Letterboxd. I was just on the page for Escape from New York, probably about to post some drivel that came to mind about watching it for so many times, and I – hovered across Jamie Lee Curtis on the cast list. I'm like, she's not in that. And then there you go.
I watched an interview from the producer, Deborah Hill, the other day, and she said with all the movies that John Carpenter was releasing around that time, like she said they had a great family on set but also offset, very tight-knit. So the likes of obviously herself, John Carpenter, Kurt Russell, Jamie Lee Curtis, Adrian Barbeau, a number of characters like Frank Doubleday that he used across a number of films.
Well, absolutely. Well, Tom Atkins was in The Fog as well. He played one of the police chiefs, I believe. There's quite a few. Charles Cyphers, I think. Mm. He was in Halloween and The Fog and Assault on Precinct 13. You're right. They were very much like a family.
Yeah, and she said, like, that's why they kept going back, because they just loved being around each other and obviously worked well together. And the other thing was that Jamie Lee Curtis, I believe, never had that original opening piece of dialogue. And I sent this to you a few months ago, and I don't think you'd seen it prior to then, was that alternative opening. There was originally another scene that John Carpenter created where Snake Plissken is essentially robbing a bank, and then it shows him come back to try and save his friend that ends up getting shot down. What happened was he had some friends around to watch the film when he thought he'd finished editing it, and his friend said, we kind of didn't know what was really happening till halfway through it. It sort of went from this bank robbery straight into New York. It also showed that Snake Plissken had a redeeming quality.
Yeah.
Carpenter realized, okay, so he cut that completely because he wanted Snake to be badass and essentially put Jamie Lee Curtis' dialogue in. She could set up the premise with 3 or 4 minutes of talking. It works so much better that way.
Was it just them talking about it, or was there some footage shot for that?
No, there's some footage on YouTube. If you look up Escape from New York alternative opening, yeah, it goes for probably 10 minutes. He's got a friend and himself. They're robbing a bank or robbing some sort of safe, and then they take a train and they think they're safe. They're getting at another train station, and then all of a sudden in comes like a SWAT squad of sorts and mows down his mate. Snake basically goes to run away on him, but then decides to come back and then puts his hands up, and that's how he's taken to prison. For me, it doesn't leave Snake looking like the real machine of hatred and that he really is in the rest of the film. And Kurt Russell's touched on that it was the best move they could have done by taking that out, because
that takes away a lot of the mystery of who he is, too.
Exactly.
He just arrives and they're like, everyone knows who this dude is. The audience don't. We're introduced to him pretty cold. He's brought in. We know that he's a war hero that's done something wrong and has turned to criminal ways, but not seeing that's even better. So they've made the right choice there for sure.
Yeah, for sure. No backstory is a powerful thing to have in his
instance. Absolutely. Yeah, don't need my handheld, thank you. I want to see this badass dude just fucking drop straight into the middle of crime-riddled New York, and I just want to see him go to town. There is just so many good moments in this film. I'm just going through now my thoughts and recollections of what goes down. I particularly liked, like I said before, that scene in the theater when he meets Cabby. I love the wrestling scene.
Oh, yes. Ox Baker.
Ox Baker, I love that scene. It's kind of reminiscent too. You did mention to me that you watched Escape from LA after watching this for the first time. Is that correct?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Look, it doesn't touch on this in any way, really, but, man, I still really loved it.
Oh, it's fun as. I fucking love it. The surfing, that is incredible. But, like, there isn't a sport that Snake isn't incredible at as well. So not only is he, you know, the guy to bring in for life and death situations, but if you need him to hit a half-court buzzer beater in basketball, he can fucking do that in LA. He can beat the most gnarliest of wrestlers. Like, the dude, he is just an all-rounder in every sense of the word.
I've actually got, like, quite a number of, like, funny or interesting little moments from this film as well that I'd love to run past you and get your thoughts.
Yeah, go for it, mate. Yeah, for it.
Okay, well, the very first scene, we have two criminals on a raft and they've got some pretty dodgy oars and they're trying to row across the water to the wall and get out. And then we see the police in their helicopter over the speakers say, you've got 10 seconds to turn around and head back or we'll shoot. It pans back to the raft and this one poor bastard has got like this little piece of wood and you can see he's frantically trying to turn the boat around.
Yeah, and they just don't let him.
It wouldn't even be 4 seconds and they're sending in homing missiles and you see these bodies like shooting 25 meters out of the water.
That's probably a moment that makes me laugh the most in the movie now. It's like, you've got 10 seconds to turn around and then almost instantly they just fucking blow them up anyway. Love that part. I love it. There's another part towards the end which I always get a real good chuckle out of, but I don't want to spoil it for anyone that hasn't seen the film, but it involves the cab trying to get over the bridge. And I get a real good laugh out of that, but I won't say too much more. I don't want to spoil it for anyone that hasn't seen it yet. What other moments were you going to mention, mate? Because that is, I'm glad you brought that up, because that always makes me laugh.
Okay, the next one I've got here, Snake and Maggie, now they both have a gun throughout the film. They appear to have unlimited bullets. Like, there's scenes that they seem to shoot, like, constantly 20 or 30 times. Never have to reload, just unlimited. If anyone watches it and just take note of how many times they shoot in some particular scene.
Because we're in the future, Hulse, it's just 1997, mate. We've got unlimited ammo, and it's the Pliskinverse. It's the Pliskinverse. he is that much of a badass, he doesn't have to fucking stop and do, like, these really dull things like reloading a weapon.
Yeah. Speaking of Maggie as well, like, obviously now Maggie, who's played by Adrienne Barbeau, who was married to John Carpenter at the time.
Yep.
And the dress that she's wearing, obviously they're accentuating her cleavage throughout the film in this particular movie.
Oh, I hadn't noticed. Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't put that past you because I think I still looked at her hair more. It was just crazy hair. I think after watching The Fog and then to see what they put on top of a melon for Escape from New York, it's just, I don't know, it's like the cleavage and the hair is taken on one-on-one. But the next thing, Hauk's walkie-talkie that he uses near the end is bigger than his head.
And it's huge.
It looks like he's got like a TARDIS in his hand.
Yeah. Look, it's 1997. There's been all these advances in technology, somewhat. I mean, you look at it now, it's funny. But they've managed to isolate one of the largest cities in the world and just make it a massive shit fight, which, you know what? The new incoming president might just do the same thing. By the end of his next 4 years, New York might look the same. But they've still got a walkie-talkie that's the size of my fucking air conditioner in my room.
My next one is the cat. Now I could actually picture you, like, out of all the friends I have, I think you're the only one that I could picture driving this is a Cadillac with chandeliers on the bonnet. Like, it feels like a Dennis Rodman or Chippy sort of vehicle to me.
So the first time you see the Duke, and he's got that fucking caddy with all the trinkets and all the fixings, man, that is some of the coolest shit ever. That's what everyone in this movie is cool. Like, everyone is cool. And the vehicle is amazing. That is, yeah, I loved it. You were right. I would drive that around now. Proudly.
Yeah, for sure. Proudly. I wouldn't put past you 1 second. Next one I got. This is going back to your favourite scene in the theatre. Now, it appears through the movie, and this is something I only noticed on today's watch, is there's actually no electricity because throughout all the scenes, you see a number of torches and fires and people holding candles. Yet the theatre is lit up almost as good as if you go to the IMAX today with the lights on. So, yeah, but when you watch it, it's clever because Carpenter, every angle that he shoots it, he has a flame showing. Even if it's through a doorway, he'll have like a flame on as if to interpret, look, it's fire that's lighting up this world. Yeah. But, yeah, these fires put out a lot of lumens. So,
which, you know what I'm glad about because – there's been a lot of chat on Twitter about how poorly lit movies are these days. And it's true. Some of the films that get released on the streaming services from Amazon and Netflix, they just look like fucking muddy sludge whenever there's a night scene. Things just aren't lit or backlit properly anymore. Mm. The pushback against boomers like me saying that is, yeah, but it's... real, it's meant to be realistic. It's displaying realism. And even though the lighting in some of, and I know exactly the scenes you're talking about, even during the wrestling and stuff too, there's just too much light for what could possibly be there without electricity. But it's needed. It gives clarity and depth to what you're looking at as well. So I love it. But I also do love, and like you said, mate, is the fact that Carpenter's always got a light source somewhere around to kind of explain it. Oh, yes, this very small candle this man is holding is lighting up the entire theater. Absolutely.
But I think what you say there with modern movies, when I watched the Indiana Jones series, sorry to touch back on that, but the lighting in the first four that Steven Spielberg shoots, then it goes to Dial of Destiny, and Dial of Destiny feels so flat and drab with its lighting. And in particular, once again, the first two, the way that Harrison Ford, when he enters a cave or and even an outdoor shot, the way that Spielberg lights it is just, like, it's worth watching those films just for that. I think Carpenter's done an amazing job of this. I just assumed there was electricity because whenever they were indoors, it was quite well lit up. But the lighting outside is so dark and hits the money there because you want it to look absolutely.
Yeah. I love all those like bluey streetscapes as well. The moonlight and there's that slight artificial lighting coming in again, but it's so well coloured, and you got the shadows draping on areas, and then people emerging from those shadows. Like it's so well done. And again, I don't want to be shaking my fist at the sky like an old man, but you watch Escape from New York, especially if you can now watch that on Blu-ray or 4K or whatever. Did you watch this on 4K?
Yeah, 4K, yep.
4K. I think I haven't watched it on 4K yet. I've only seen it. I'm only slumming it and watching it on Blu-ray, you know.
You're one of them.
Yeah. Just one of these fucking losers. It just pops, right? This is a film that's made on a shoestring budget with fucking cardboard sets half the time, but it looks better than these $250 million massive box office earning films that are coming out today. Yeah. I had to see Wicked recently. Oh, goodness gracious me. I don't even want to – I want to forget about that movie as soon as I walked out. I didn't look up what the budget would be, but I'd be horrified at what they spent to make a film that looks like complete dog shit, right? It is just, again – and like you touched on with that latest Indiana Jones movie, the craft is kind of missing these days with a lot of the directors, and it's a shame because it's becoming a bit of a lost art. Hopefully there's a renaissance with film directors coming out and they're learning how to do proper staging and shot composition and some lighting, because it's really becoming a lost art. And you see it in a movie such as this, a $6 million budget, and it just looks so beautiful at times.
Touching on the location shooting for this particular film, we didn't mention it earlier, but because obviously they could not shut down New York, probably the only city that you absolutely 100% no chance of
being. But Cameron Crowe did for you for Vanilla Sky temporarily for a few minutes.
Well, Cameron Crowe's my boy, but this one was interesting because at the time John Carpenter couldn't. So what they found was an area in St. Louis where they'd had a disastrous fire go through a number of buildings, which allowed them to, and they had an agreement with the, I don't know, the mayor or the government in that area, so that they were allowed to use it from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. every night for a week or a couple of weeks or whatever it was. So every night they'd set up all the debris, the fires, you know, all the barrels with the fires. They even got pulled in a real plane carcass. And then every morning they would have to get a bulldozer to clean it all up because at 6 p.m. they'd open the roads again so everyone could go to work. This is how they shot it for, I forget how many days in a row, but that's what they had to do every single night. So they did all their shooting at night and then at, you know, must be like 4 a.m. they'd start cleaning it up and then have the roads open at 6 a.m., which I think is just insane.
That is incredible. It's like borderline guerrilla filmmaking, really. Mm. Like going in and just totally transforming a place overnight and then having to rip it all down again the next morning. I never knew that. That's incredible.
And can you touch on I didn't realize the matte paintings side of things until you sort of brought it up this week. But I mean, I did read that James Cameron, this is where he sort of started his career at the biggest stage, was this film with these matte paintings. But man, they're incredible in those opening scenes.
Yeah. So it's, again, we're talking about lost arts. This is definitely one as well. So I believe, yeah, James Cameron's foot in the door somewhat, I'm sure he has skills in most areas, was that he was an incredible artist. And he helped, I think along with John Carpenter, if I'm not wrong, helped design the cityscape, the New York cityscape that you see obviously throughout the film, but most notably at the beginning of the film when you see Air Force One flying in. That's all matte painting. It's been around since forever. One of the most notable uses of matte paintings was in Black Narcissus from 1940, I'm going to bugger this up, 47, I believe it is. So it's been around for forever. But Carpenter used it a lot, especially in his 80s run of thrillers and horror films. There's quite a prominent use of it in The Thing in 82. I'm really looking forward to you doing a Carpenter deep dive soon, because even though this is the first time we've talked about Carpenter on this show, there was The Fog in 1980, which just missed my top 10, probably would be in my top 15, I guess, of 1980. Mm. Great film, and one that I think you're going to revisit soon, aren't you?
Yeah, I was hoping to squeeze it in again before today, but I sort of got sidetracked on a few other films. So, but I reckon
it'll really hit for you now. I know that you're a little bit, you liked it, but you're like, nah, it didn't really blow you away. I think once you see a few more Carpenters, I think you'll return to that and it might elevate.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. It tends to happen with a lot of these films. Revisiting them in any kind of way, just you appreciate all the little factors that you just sort of disregard in that first viewing. So, no, I plan to try and, you know, I've already, like even Halloween, like I watched it for the first time and I'm itching to watch it again. I actually watched Halloween 2 as well, which I think he didn't direct, but he produced.
Yeah. I think he might have written the story.
Yeah.
I think he was the writer.
But I loved it too.
An interesting one to watch too. I know we're going a little bit off topic, but that's okay. We can go on tangents. It's our fucking show. We can do what we want. Halloween 3, Hulsh. Yeah. Check that out. Season of the Witch. Notable in the fact that it's doesn't have any Michael Myers in it. Yeah, so
Tom Atkins, that one, isn't it?
Yes. A film that when I first saw it when I was younger, I was like, oh, what's this shit? And now it's probably only just behind Halloween in my Halloween rankings. Not that it's hard. There's been some pretty garbage Halloween entries from the first few. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to you really deep diving on Carpenter. And, look, spoiler alert, not much of a spoiler. There's going to be a fair bit of JC in these countdowns in the coming months, years, because this dude was on such a massive hot streak. And it started in the 70s. He had Dark Star that came out. I think it might have been his debut feature. Basically, we're talking cheap, very cheap. He was using, I think it was like a beach ball or something to create some type of spaceship in that. John Carpenter really hit his stride was obviously Assault on Precinct 13. And then he had Halloween, which was the really big liftoff for his career. And then in succession, there is just banger after banger after banger. So he brings out The Fog in 1980, Escape from New York in 1981, The Thing in 1982. Like, a three-year run like that is just obscene. Christine, which is pretty underrated, another Stephen King adaptation in 83. If we're talking about underrated films, Starman in 1984, a really sweet kind of road movie with a twist. Then you got Big Trouble in Little China in 85, I believe, or 86. Prince of Darkness in 87, low-key, probably my favourite Carpenter film. And then 88, They Live. He doesn't even deliver a stinker until Memoirs of an Invisible Man in the early 90s, which was not great, which had a troubled production with, I think, Chevy Chase caused a lot of shit on set for that. But John Carpenter had like a full decade run of just banger after banger after banger. And I don't think there's been another director that's had such a prolific or consistent run over the course of a decade as he did. And what I love about him the most now is this dude that occasionally gets interviewed. He's not rude, but he just doesn't take any shit. He's an old man. He loves playing video games, and he loves, I think, just smoking weed and chilling out, watching movies and playing games. Part of me would love to see a comeback from him, but also I think the culture has changed around film. I would hate for him to bring something out that's like a passion project and just have everyone just fucking trash it on Twitter or on social media. I don't think he'd really care because he's just not the type of dude, but I'd hate something like that to tarnish his legacy. So
isn't that kind of what happened with Coppola?
Oh, absolutely, with Megalopolis. I saw that. Obviously, living in regional Queensland, Megalopolis has not touched any of the local cinemas around regional Australia. So I had to do the old-fashioned, well, not the old-fashioned way, the devious way, and basically download it off a share link that I found on Twitter. And look, I fucking loved it, but I love weirdo passion projects from like legacy directors. So I was always going to love it. I'm wired that way. I can see that it's flawed and completely strange. The response to it was largely negative, and I would hate for John Carpenter to do something like that. Yeah. But he has some late career kind of heaters. He's still got his fastball into the early 2000s. He's still bringing out some good shithole. So even though he had that clunker with Invisible Man, I can't wait for you to see In the Mouth of Madness. Fucking incredible film. That was mid-90s. You've seen Escape from LA already. Vampires is so cool. I think that was 98 or 99. James Woods, one of the most arrogant men on the planet, plays this arrogant man so well in the movie. Go figure. Mm-hmm. Fucking great movie. Even Ghosts of Mars in early 2000s has a lot of really good stuff in it as well. So, yeah, man, I'm glad we're finally talking about John Carpenter. We've got a lot of fun stuff ahead. Anything else that you of note that you wanted to talk about, Escape from New York, mate? Obviously, with me, this is a film that I've probably talked about to death over the years and have recommended to a lot of people, and not everyone's liked it. I still remember back when I was younger in my – would have been high school days, an ex-girlfriend of mine's like, what's your favorite movie? And I'm like, oh, it's this movie called Escape from New York. She's like, oh, I've never seen it. We should watch it, because she knew I was really into movies. And she absolutely fucking hated it. And I think we actually broke up not long after that. So not everyone that I've recommended this to enjoyed it. I'm very happy that you did. Yeah, was there anything else you wanted to mention, mate?
I want to give a bit of love to Donald Pleasance. His performance has actually probably grown on me the most from each rewatch. It was obviously always weird to have a US president with a British accent. And apparently Carpenter had a bit of a background for that. It was sort of like a bit of tongue-in-cheek, like as if Ronald Reagan and Thatcher had an offspring. Donald Pleasance is it. But, I mean, he does bring that humorous presence to the film throughout. And without a doubt, like, he's obviously tormented through this entire film by the Duke and all his sidekicks and so forth, because he's been captured and tortured and ridiculed. Without a doubt, the part that I laugh the hardest every single watch is when the Duke goes to put Kurt away at the snake away at the end of the film, and the president pokes his head back up over the wall and starts screaming, "You are the Duke from New York. You are A-1," and just fucking riddles him with bullets from the fucking machine gun. It's just one of those moments where, you know, he's already been saved. He's out of sight. You think that's done and dusted, and the next second the president has gone and found a machine gun and come running back just to fucking hammer this guy because of all the pain that he's put him through for the last 90 minutes of this film. It's just one of those moments, I think, out of all the movies we've watched so far, I reckon it's my biggest laugh out. Inferno's rat moment might be right up there too, but yeah, I think this one would be definitely top three for laugh out loud.
I think it's, yeah, on the same kind of level. And they were both number 10 in their respective years, so there's a bit of symmetry there as well.
This could definitely be a WTF moment for our 1981 recap when we get
to our recap. Yeah. Absolutely, because that is something you just do not expect. Because even when the plane is going down, Pleasance plays it like fairly straight. When it's been hijacked and he gets into the pod, he's like, "All right, escape pod. God bless you all." And he's very, very fucking straight through the whole thing. And then for him just to go full gun massacre towards the end is really funny. It's a great turn. You're right. It's pretty humorous to have a president with a slight accent. They're about to have a president that has a South African accent in the US anyway. So, look, you know, these things are predicted.
Just talking about the escape pod moment, for anyone that has watched it or is going to rewatch it, as the terrorists are sending the plane into the buildings, Hauk and Tom Atkins has a radar, very primitive 1980s computer style. It's like, boop, boop, boop. And the funniest thing is, it's got this dot that's just the plane. And then as it hits the building, the plane just disappears. It doesn't exist, but then this little pod dot sort of comes off the side. That plane has got like 8 or 9 Secret Service agents on it and, you know, countless other people. And the second that pod comes out and the plane explodes, they don't care about who's on that plane anymore. They're just like, "Oh, that looks like the pod just landed down there." And like literally no emotion whatsoever that this entire plane has just been evaporated into this building and this little dot goes down there. It's like, "Oh, excellent. The pod got out." So
they only care about the POTUS. They just want to make sure the POTUS is okay.
And the last thing I'll say before we wrap it up is I'd love to start a Joe Spinell Award, if possible, in our wrap-up at the...
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, so for someone
who have you got Spinelling out of this?
Well, I think, I don't know, does Frank Doubleday work as a Joe Spinell style role?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, he's a great, like, as far as character actors that just fucking steal a scene or an entire movie, for sure. But the only thing is, the unique thing about Spinell is he dominated an entire year. You know, like he was in fucking everything in 1980. And like, it was like, even if it was just for 2 seconds or for 2 scenes, like he was just in everything. So what we might do, we might keep track if we start seeing... It's going to be hard because there's a few different countries and regions featured in a few of these films I've picked. So there might not be a few of these actors that travel, so to speak. Yeah. But if we do pick up a bit of a theme on a character actor that really stands out and just ends up showing up in everything, let's do the Spinell Award. That's a great idea.
Yeah, yeah. I just think he sort of led the way. You know, he was the pioneer, and now we should probably, you know, take his lead and give some kudos to these guys that, you know, do these little character roles but make the movie infinitely better because of them.
Yeah, Doubleday is Spinelling hard, now that you say it. That is a really good fucking shout. That is brilliant. One more thing I want to say before we wrap it up too is it's funny how things go full circle. This is my favorite film forever up until, I don't know, I became a real fucking wanker cinema watcher and started expanding my horizon somewhere. But this was my favorite film up until, I guess, being a mid-teenager. And not long after that, I started playing a video game which then became my favorite video game of all time, and that is Metal Gear Solid 2, Sons of Liberty. the main character in that is a guy called Solid Snake, and he has an eye patch.
Wow.
He has a bit of a mullet. He smokes. He has a code name, Plissken. So it's pretty obvious. One of the great video game developers and directors, Hideo Kojima, has come out and said, yeah, obviously heavily influenced by Escape from New York and Kurt Russell's depiction of Snake Plissken. So just when I thought I'd kind of grown out of my Escape from New York addiction, I started playing a video game that basically was featuring him as well.
A few weeks ago, I saw a poll because PlayStation, you know, they've got their 30-year anniversary and they did the top 100 games of all time. And I think Metal Gear Solid came in number one.
No way.
I've got a feeling it did.
I mean, I'm not surprised it would rank highly. I just did not think it would go as high as one. Like, I just didn't think.
Yeah, don't quote me on it, but I thought it was definitely right up there.
Fuck yeah, if it did. Yeah, hell yeah. I'm riding that. That's awesome.
Yeah. That's pretty cool that it had such an influence on you know, a game that's regarded potentially the best of the last 30 years.
All right. Well, that's episode one, season two done, man. Number 10. For 1981, Escape from New York, directed by John Carpenter. Look, if you're a listener and you haven't watched this, what the fuck are you doing? This movie is just so much fun. Let me see the time here. I'm just going to cheat and go into Letterboxd. It is a breezy 99 minutes. That's in the pocket of the perfect film time, you know? So if you haven't seen it, watch it. Easy. Anything else to add to that, Holsh?
Not to the movie, but I actually do have a letter from a listener, if you don't mind me sharing it, mate.
Are you kidding?
Oh, I'm not kidding.
My God.
It's from a gentleman called David Bailey, and he said, "Dear Ryan and Holsh, absolutely love the pod and have followed it along since the beginning, watching all the movies from the 1980 top 10. Always get pumped when I receive a notification for the next episode. Just wanted to point out to Holsh, though, that Superman actually makes planet Earth spin backward in the 1978 original, not Superman 2. Keep up the great work, guys." And I know he's done me there. So I went back and checked, and he's correct. Now, the original has the backward spinning to reverse time, so Lois Lane forgets his identity. And number two is actually like it's probably not a WTF moment, because all he does there is have a magical kiss that takes her memory. So I'm actually taking the piss there. That is a WTF moment. So
instead of turning the world back, he Bill Cosby'd her drink? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
That's exactly what he did.
So that's still a WTF fucking moment, man. And look, don't feel too bad, because when you were telling me that, I'm like, yeah, I remember that. But I obviously hadn't. I don't think I'd – I think I've seen Superman and Superman 2 like maybe once back when I was a kid. But yeah. I do remember the reversal. Yeah. I don't remember the Bill Cosby thing.
Yeah. To be fair, whenever I go to watch – like in that instance, Superman 2 was 1980, I always watch the first one. So I would have watched them back to back. And then when I was pulling together the WTF moments, it's obviously got blended in. But either way, Superman's full of WTFs. So
absolutely. Look, I'm buzzing, man. We got a letter. That's amazing.
Yeah, really cool. So thanks, David. I'm glad you've followed all 10 so far. So that's awesome.
Thanks, David. I appreciate the feedback, even if it is to call us out on some bullshit. Thanks, man. We will be back again in the next week or so with our number 9 for 1981. Whatever could it be? You'll just have to tune in and find out. Awesome. Thanks, Holsh. Great chat. I'll talk to you again soon. And thanks, listeners. We'll be back soon. Bye.